everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
This week, I was lucky enough to talk to co-founder of PopBitch, Camilla Wright. We spoke about the reasons behind the celebrity gossip site's longevity in a crowded niche, the weirdest things that have happened as a result of founding the site, and what she'd love to do with the brand if they had more resources. So hopefully we are seeing some of you this week at the launch event of our first report, Media Moments 2018. If you can make it, fantastic. If you can't, do check the newsletter this week for a download link for the report. There's an awful lot to get through in the news roundup this week, so we'll begin with this. Peter, sorry seems to be the hardest word. Is that fair to say when NME is doing the most successfully it's ever done?
Well, a little bit, but not much. Because it's different. And this is a great story. Because if you read this thing, it's in The Drum. It's an interview by Cameron Clark. He talked to Charlotte Gunn, who's the editor of NME Online now, digital only. And this is a good story. This is a success story. They stopped being in print in March, became profitable almost immediately, according to this interview. And they've changed back, I think, to what they used to be. Not to what they used to be when I liked them, when it was all guitar bands and post-punk good stuff. The music's still crap, but at least pop in the sense of massively commercial pop that everyone in the street is going to pick up. They've gone back to that kind of roots of having an opinion and doing reviews and being a real honest to God music magazine. I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry about bagging on Rihanna on the cover. What was that about?
Well, I mean, where have you been? I mean, yeah, I think it's fair to say that you were quite a rude boy about this, right? Man down in terms of, you know, another magazine bites the dust. But I feel like now they can take a bow. They can stay.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm not, you know, my problem with this was what they became when they went free. And they've unbecome that.
So they went into, you're saying they sort of went into rehab as a brand, and now they're coming out and they should just shut up and drive and just carry on down this path,
Chris,
of success.
Stop.
Jesus.
Stop it. No.
All right. So there's a really good quote in this piece in The Drum about this, where they said, "From the moment we closed the print mag, we were a profitable business again." So, I mean, that's quite telling, isn't it? The fact that they did have this huge legacy tail, but now they've kind of found their feet again as a purely digital brand. If you look at what happened with Hearst this week, they're basically saying that print will no longer be as huge a portion of their business as it once was.
I thought that Hearst story, though, was interesting because they're still talking about half their revenue being in print. You know, going from 60% to 50%, that's still a lot.
It is. I mean, it's an announcement that it is going to shrink further. I don't think 50% is going to be, like, the bottom of that well.
No, probably not. You know what? I like this story. I'm happy. I love the way she... I don't know Charlotte Gunn at all, but I love the way she talks about this. The fact that she's talking about, you know, the distribution model, the free model meant that they had to be all things to all people, and now they don't need to be that. They can take a few more risks. Digital's a bit different. They can have a range of stuff, and people won't be offended by, you know, Rihanna being next to whatever the latest, I don't know what the youth's listening to these days. I'm having a clue.
Esther, what do you think about
Cardi
what they're doing
B.
in terms of, yeah, Cardi B? But Esther, they're doing a lot around video as well. Do you think this is going to work?
Well, I think it's the way they're approaching the video. So they're doing, rather than the kind of minute and a half social clips that they used to do on YouTube, they're prioritising longer form interviews with, I think, what they call A-list talent. I wouldn't know what that is in music. But yeah, it seems to be working for them. In September, they had their biggest ever month. They had 30 million watch minutes from 4.4 million views, which means like people are really engaged. Oh gosh, I hate that word. But that's double the month before, so it seems to be paying off. And yeah, I'm really happy that they're going for this.
Moving on then, the newly united Lad Bible and Unilad have both seen Facebook engagement drop in October. So Lad Bible snapped up Unilad after it went into administration earlier this last month. And between the two of them, they have consistently claimed the top spots in Facebook likes, shares and comments prior to the acquisition, according to Newswhip, which basically does aggregation of all the, you know, the most successful publishers on Facebook. It's interesting, isn't it, that something that we've basically said can happen to any publisher where Facebook can just turn the spigot off has now happened to arguably the two companies that have made the biggest gains on Facebook.
I don't think this isn't due to Facebook, though, for once. For once, this is not Facebook's fault. yeah, I think because of what's happened with the takeover and always trying to get them the right way around, Unilad has dropped to 17th place. They're the ones that went into administration, and basically staff were put on like a big hold for a couple of weeks, like they couldn't really access anything. So output actually dropped quite a bit as well. So in that sense, the fact that engagement is halved is in line with that. Again, like, it's difficult to see where this is going to go. Are the two brands going to kind of really properly consolidate, or are they going to carry on trying to kind of rival each other the top spots under that umbrella? It's a bit difficult to know where that's going.
I was going to say, do you think maybe they just lost focus and they've just been spending so much time worrying about who's doing what and who owns what and who's responsible for what, that they've just lost focus and that's, you know, they're not putting out as much stuff or as good stuff or whatever. Good, I used good.
You know, I heard it as you said it and I was about to leave it.
In inverted commas.
Well, the interesting thing here is that, you know, Facebook has been trying to optimize for time well spent. And, you know, Esther, you're probably very right that it's a lot in terms of, you know, the amount of content that they can actually produce given kind of the strictures that they're under at the moment. But I wonder if this is, at least in part, the idea that, you know, Facebook's time well spent metric is starting to bite. Because if you look at the guys who are now up at the top of that chart in terms of, you know, Facebook engagement, it's the NYT, it's CNN, it's Fox News, it's the BBC. Those are, for the most part, outlets that you would associate with quality.
But that wasn't what Facebook said time well spent was about,
no.
Was it?
Yeah, and I've got to say, the other thing I've got to factor into October is the fact that it was a run-up to midterms.
Mm.
And I think it was the drum that pointed out that actually there's always some change. Like Unilad and Lad Bible, yes, they do a bit of political coverage, but they're not like hard on it. So we'd naturally see people like CNN, NYT, Fox News rising to the top of that anyway. And also Breitbart. So it's not about Google's quality time well spent algorithm. It's I think it's just with subject changes.
Ah, you've preempted well. I was about to lay down the twist of like, but who else is on the list? It's interesting, isn't it, that it seems, but their entire business model is based on Facebook shares. This to me doesn't seem like the greatest vote of confidence in this new combined company anyway.
Except, and I've got to say, I'm not going to spoil this because this is in the report. So download Media Moments 2018 this week. Yes, they might have the top spots regularly in Facebook. The revenue they make from that is pitiful. And I'm not going to say the numbers. You're going to have to look at the report yourself for that.
Ooh,
nice.
Teaser.
Good tease. And finally, Axios is on track to make $20 million in revenue. And it might even have an outside shot at profitability, according to Digiday. What's going on with this one, Esther?
They didn't launch that long ago, and they seem to be doing pretty well. But what baffled me about this one is that they're looking to launch what they call high-end subscription products. They've got one in the pipeline that costs $10,000 a year.
I think what's interesting about this, I think, is the corporate cognitive dissonance between because Axios does brilliant stuff. The Axios media newsletter is brilliant. So they do great stuff. And I could see where they could charge money for subscriptions, maybe not $10,000 a year. But then they're having all sorts of crap going on with their reputation around the journalism being done by one of the reporters, Jonathan Swan, got overexcited with a scoop interviewing Trump about banning bright citizenship for kids that are born in America getting automatic citizenship. And just it's a whole mess. And then they're doing this show on HBO, and the reporting of this so-called scoop with Trump saying something that he actually couldn't legally do. Oh, there's a surprise. They kind of led with, we've got this scoop, Trump saying this. And by the way, if you watch our HBO show at 6:30 p.m. Eastern time, blah, blah, blah. And staff inside the company seem to be getting really uncomfortable about it. So they've got a bit of commercial dissonance going on.
Was it also not a scoop?
It's not a scoop because it's not true.
Yeah.
Well, that just sums up American politics.
There's a great piece. I think I'll try and find a link. There was a great piece explaining this guy, Jonathan Swan, who by all accounts is a great reporter, gets in there, really gets the story, but he's ruffling some feathers because it's almost like he's inserting his personality in between him, sort of himself in the story. And when the story's Trump, that's just too many personalities for one story.
The other problem with a lot of this is that, you know, if they're looking to launch their subscription products, apart from the fact that the trust has to be absolutely watertight. You've got to have something that really differentiates you, because if they're going to do it in business, you know, you've got a lot of competition from business side, a lot of the big business brands. If you're doing it in media, you've got the information. I don't think what they're doing at the moment, like, yes, their newsletter is fantastic, but what is what they're doing at the moment enough to justify like a high-end subscription price? I don't think at the moment it is.
Moving on then, in brief, the BBC is launching a huge international anti-disinformation drive this week. The New York Times is planning to introduce a dynamic paywall in order to drive subscriptions, and you can find out more about the trend for flexible paywalls in our report, Media Moments 2018. Facebook have rejected the invite we talked about last week. That's a shocker, to appear in front of the joint UK-Canada International Grand Committee, saying that Zuckerberg can't appear before all parliaments, which is awkward as Australia, Argentina and Ireland have since joined. 15 years after launching a paywall, Shipstead Media has over 1 million print and digital subscribers, with reader revenue making up 40% of the division's revenue. And Scots, in fact, you know what, Peter, you take this one.
Scots love local newspapers more than the English because they're smarter and better looking. Or maybe because they just don't get out the house as much, I don't know. Six of the top 19 regional papers in the UK are actually Scottish. Because we all know if it's not Scottish, it's crap.
Is that because Scots people haven't got the internet yet?
Oh, hey,
shots fired.
So we're now able to offer transcripts of our interviews thanks to our partnership with Trint. They have a really cool AI automated transcription tool for audio and video. So you can look out for more details both about them and the transcripts in our weekly newsletter. Or if you want to get added to our exclusive email list to receive the transcripts as soon as they go live, just drop us a line.
This week I interviewed Camilla Wright. She's co-founder of Potbitch, and so we spoke about the celebrity gossip site's success in an extremely crowded world. We spoke about everything from the romanticism of clandestine meetings in dark pubs to whether celebrities ever try to plant stories about themselves. And I began by asking her why she launched the site in the first place.
Right, that's a long way back. I started Potbitch with, two of us started it in, I guess, turn of the century, sort of December 99, January 2000. And at that time, I was a freelance journalist. I started in a more cerebral world, sort of politics and economics, and kind of gone sideways into doing things like pop music reviews in my spare time, and actually finding that was an infinitely preferable way of spending time. So I ended up doing a lot of celebrity interviews for style magazines and music magazines, and some Sunday supplements, that kind of thing. And my partner at the time, Neil Stevenson, was at Heat magazine. So between the two of us, we were kind of in the sort of celebrity journalism world a bit, but coming up against the fact that, particularly in those days, everything was very reverent, everything was very copy controlled, and that you ended up talking about to your friends in journalism or in PR the things you could never get into the interviews, or that nothing particularly damning, nothing particularly bad, but just kind of the funny things that you wanted to talk about were always the bits that were taken out. So we thought we'd try and go back to the spirit of the sort of 80s and 90s journalism of smash hits and things like that, and try and put together meant to be stories for our friends and associates, really. And around that time was the first time that we saw email newsletters being sent around, and we thought, what if we just put together an email and send it out? Then it's kind of free, we can get things off our chest, it'll be a fun way of circulating stories just between a few people, and hey, you never know, we might get a better job out of it. And weirdly enough, it just took off.
So I mean, Potbitch seems to have it has an outsized influence. So do you attribute that to the fact that you were almost first to market with this kind of newsletter driven, as you said, kind of irreverent approach to what you publish?
I think being first was a real help. I mean, it cut through so much because people wanted to know about it and be part of it. But I think also that we've always had a very strong commitment to sort of the strength of the journalism, to the even things like the quality of the proofreading, the sub-editing. So we are sending out a kind of finite, edited, curated selection of stories each week in a way that a lot of people sort of on the internet have kind of perpetuated, a sort of always on 24/7, just chuck it up, and if you need to edit it, you can keep doing it. So I think there's people have taken notice of it because this is obviously something we've spent time and energy putting together rather than just thrown out there. And I think that's really helped. There have been times over the last 18 years where other platforms have taken people's attention, but it's we're looking at our readership and looking at the kind of people that read it. It's I mean, there's a lot of people in the industry, obviously journalists and people in the media, and a lot of celebrities, and therefore we've always taken it on board that we're writing to a very connected audience, and therefore it's really important to get things right.
Yeah, certainly. I think that its longevity kind of speaks to the, you know, how good of a strategy that actually was. And if you look at the wider publishing world now, you do see that everybody's trying to emulate, or everyone's trying to kind of adopt their own, you know, finite newsletter-based or edition-based publishing strategy, yeah. Which actually speaks to more fundamentally how people choose to consume news and content online.
I think that's right. I mean, it's sometimes it's been dark days when we've been the only people saying this is actually what people want to see, and advertisers and sponsors are like, well, we don't want to give you any money. We want some flashy graphics-driven video. Everyone had that pivot to video. If you remember that a few years ago, newspapers, magazines, and now obviously everyone's kind of quietly forgetting it because nobody watched it, nobody wanted to read it. So I think there's definitely something to the fact that there's only a certain amount of information you can consume.
No, I mean, that absolutely makes sense. If you look at the people who are, you know, doing incredibly well and, you know, have, you know, many, many more resources than you do, it's, you know, your pools, it's your NYTs, it's your kind of edition-based guys. And they make the kind of the respect of their audience's time the very basis of everything they do, and it's working out really well for them.
Yeah, I guess we'll see where things go. There's definitely truth in that.
So we've spoken then about sort of the newsletters, mentioned them a bit. Does that tend to be how most of your audience reaches your content?
Yes, I mean, we've tried a few things over the years, but we're very much focused on a weekly newsletter. It goes out to, we've got about 310,000 active subscribers. So
nice.
At the minute we send it out, within about an hour, you've got about 150,000 people picking it up. So you've got a very quick impact on sort of media and popular culture there. So that is how we pick things up. We in the last year or so, we've been trialing sort of long features alongside this, sort of 10, 20, 30,000 word features, sort of digging a bit deeper into the, I guess, where sort of politics and popular culture and celebrity intersect. So things involving kind of how Donald Trump's rise through, I guess, through a sort of celebrity and tabloid world to politics. And recently we've been looking at, I guess, how things like Max Clifford, Simon Cowell, Jonathan King, Mark Williams Thomas, sort of four big sort of figures in popular culture, again, have intersected and, I suppose, influence how media and celebrity are covered.
Yeah, there's a sort of social history aspect to it as well.
Yeah, social history.
You know, I mentioned back at the start of the call that this is the interview that my friends have been most excited about, precisely because Popbitch is so, it's the antithesis of that kind of very stage-managed, very anodyne approach to kind of celebrity news, which you get, and you increasingly get now in the world of social.
Yeah, that's right. It's strange the growth of social and how it's changed perceptions of celebrity and celebrity media, in that in one way we're all closer to the stars because it's like you follow them on Twitter, you follow them on Instagram and get their insights, but so very few actually, I think, are the architects of their own output, that you're getting an even more staged and fake version than when it was gone through the conduit of a magazine or a newspaper. The idea was, if you take out the middlemen, people writing about the stars, you'd feel much closer to them. But I think it's actually gone the other way around, and there's a lack of humanity, lack of normality as well in this now, in that people want to be perceived for, it's all very kind of fake positive, isn't it? This is me, this is my house, these are my new shoes, this is what I'm getting sponsored for, and you never really see the others. I mean, some people are very good at it. You look at people like, I think possibly Gary Lineker is the best at this. You feel like you're actually getting a real grown-up person talking to you, but very few people are like that.
Yeah. It's Gary Lineker and it's the skateboarder Tony Hawk, who seems to exclusively share stories about how miserable his life has become. And I think my favorite one was still he was at the airport and somebody said, "Are you Tony Hawk?" And he said, "Yeah." And they said, "Why?" And you know, he just reported that on social. And you go, "What a terrible experience for him!" But you know, very authentic in that he was willing to share it.
I was listening to a podcast the other day that an American one from the New York Times journalist. There was a New York Times and a Rolling Stone journalist bemoaning the kind of how suddenly they were being cut out of the sort of celebrity media loop, that, you know, go back 2 or 3 years, they could get anybody they wanted to be interviewed and go anywhere in the world. And now suddenly celebrities were circumventing them because they didn't really need a magazine cover anymore. They could put out beautiful photographs on Instagram, much like sort of Beyonce.
Yeah.
For example, does. And they were kind of complaining about this, and I was just thinking, this is so weird. This is what 20 years ago we had here. That you weren't as big as the New York Times or the Rolling Stone. Everybody else has been fucked over by sort of PRs for this long, and actually if they'd kind of, you know, hadn't just kind of pulled up the drawbridge and said, well, we're all right, we're gonna just carry on, and actually taken us, and if people had for longer taken a stand and not just kind of replicated anything that celebrities want to do and every catered to their whim, and every utterance on Twitter, every picture on Instagram is kind of picked up and put on websites and put on all over newspapers. So if everybody hadn't done that, then there might be more of a celebrity culture,
Celebrity
media, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's as soon as kind of celebrity news became commodified.
There's a downside to doing kind of the kind of thing we do as well, though, because I guess in order to write the stories you want, you have to forego access to stars and parties, so that the PR companies, the agents, the management companies, record labels, if you don't do and say what they want, they cut you out. We don't always get to go to the flashy parties, the junkets, the interviews, that kind of thing. So you have to sort of say, okay, well, I won't do that, and therefore I will write what I want. And that, I think on a more serious note, that's sort of how someone like Harvey Weinstein got away with his behavior for so long, because he made sure that he had all the stars, he had all the invites, the best parties. And so, I mean, this is not a criticism of any of the magazines or newspapers in that ecosystem, but they actually couldn't function if they didn't go along with what they were told to say and do, because you wouldn't have got the Oscar-winning actress on your front cover. You wouldn't have gone to the parties and find out what had happened. So it's a very, very difficult world to navigate. We send out text rather than pictures, and we deliver it straight to someone's inbox so that we, you know, it circumvents this. But
from the sound of it, from the kind of your subscriber numbers, it sounds like the audience appreciates that, the kind of the relevancy and not having traded access for authenticity there. So over the years, then, we've spoken a little bit about how, you know, your delivery mechanism has kind of remained very much the same, although you're trying new things. Have the means by which stories reach you changed as tech and society have changed as well? Or is it sort of very much still the kind of shoe leather, or rather kind of just kind of insider knowledge that gets you most of your stories?
Actually, there has been changes over the years and connected with technology, but also I guess as we've grown and got to know people as well. When we started out, there was a few personal contacts, but things came in either by email, or we used to have quite a legendary message board. It was a sort of forum for media insiders.
Yeah.
People used to, you know, use a pseudonym and post up there. But I guess over time, as people became aware of the fact that they could be traced sometimes from their postings, their IP addresses are not always safe, or, you know, what doing things on company email can come back to bite you. There was over time, there was a movement away from that. So we started to, I guess, go back to some of the old days of Fleet Street, where you would meet people in a dark pub or a sort of somewhere where nobody would see you, and nothing would ever be committed to paper. You'd get the stories you wanted and write them down. Nobody would ever know who it was coming from. So that became I guess, another way of doing it. We still get a lot of things, unsolicited stories by email. You have to kind of work out who it's coming from and where.
Yeah.
But increasingly now, with the use of closed messaging groups, is really useful. WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, things like that, where you can perhaps, it's perhaps slightly less risky to share information to us. It's come full circle. We sort of started digital, then we came back into the the real world, and now we're increasingly going back into a sort of like a digital world upgrade.
Yeah, there's a weird romanticism to the idea of, you know, kind of these dark, dingy pubs where you it's what I think of as being real journalism in a way. I guess it's because it's how it was presented in media for so long. So it's romantic.
It's true, actually. We've started doing kind of monthly, almost like a drinking den, trying to evoke the spirit of old Fleet Street, where we invite a few people in to a sort of secret cellar, ply them with drinks on the understanding that everybody in the room will keep each other's secrets, but that if we share them, we could, you know, find out a bit more about what's actually going on in the world of entertainment. And then we, you know, somebody stays sober enough to write write it up, but that's about it. So
yeah,
there is something the connection in the real world of meeting people is still, even in a digital landscape, is still really important.
Yeah,
and I think
for sure.
A lot of reporters, a lot of people now on their magazines and newspapers and websites, being told they just have to sit behind a computer and rewrite other things, are starting to get quite anti it. And I think there might be, hopefully in the future, a sort of renaissance of reporting, because that's why we all go into doing this, because we want to find out stories. And at some point, I think maybe the commercial departments of media will realise that's actually what people want to read as well.
Yeah, nice. And it's just moving on there slightly, it sounds like you, Popwitch is still a tiny team, right? How many people are there, I suppose, full-time is the easiest way to say it?
There's two of us full-time. We have a back office of sort of admin and tech people as well, who are not full-time, but they do the service for sort of two or three other people. And then we have a team of maybe a dozen who run our events or who work on a freelance basis, sort of project by project. So we're a tiny team, but if we were ever lucky enough to get the funding together, we could grow pretty quickly into quite an interesting outfit, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that was my next question, was if you had those resources, then what would be, you know, how would you expand the brand? What would you do differently?
We've never ever done any kind of marketing or, I guess, attempts to increase our audience except through sort of word of mouth and just sending stuff out there. It would be nice to be able to spend some money telling people who don't necessarily know about Popwitch that this is an option for them, I guess, to read. That would be, I think there's the potential audience for something like this is bigger than, I mean, it's really nice to get 310,000, but it's potentially a lot bigger than that. But at the moment, we're hamstrung by the fact that there's a small number of us doing it. So we tend to put out our large, our sort of long features monthly rather than weekly.
Yeah.
But it'd be fantastic to be able to do more of that sort of investigative work. And I guess, you know, the more stories you put out, the more you need in the legal fund. So
yeah, of course. Yeah, I was going to say, it's sort of I always think about Private Eye when I think about, you know, kind of this, your sort of publishing, and just think their legal team must be so busy, waking up every day just incredibly stressed about everything. I really don't envy them. So just two final questions, because I really appreciate the time you've given us so far. One is, you mentioned at the start that Popwitch was effectively a punt. You know, it was an idea that, you know, maybe other people within sort of your circle would enjoy this, and it's kind of grown into this kind of whole, you know, company and this kind of this cultural touchstone from there. Is there any one incident that you can think of when you found that there's no way you could have foreseen yourself in that situation?
I suppose there's been a few moments. We ended up having the Columbia Review of Journalism asking to do a long feature on our journalism. That was kind of weird. I was a witness at the Leveson inquiry for the press, and talking to Lord Leveson about some of the content of Popwitch was pinch myself that was
must have been so surreal.
But also, we, you know, you see now that you look at we can see who's reading it, and sometimes I can't quite believe that some of the people reading it are actually reading it, or, you know, people who will then email you or message you about something that's been in it, and I never give their names away, but it amazes me every single week.
Nice. Do you ever get people trying to, I guess they're kind of, the whether it's celebrities or politicians or agents, trying to stage manage things by coming directly to you and sort of pitching stuff that they know is going to be favourable to their clients?
Yes, that does happen. An interesting one happened the other day. Did you see the GQ article on Johnny Depp where they'd basically
completely ignored everything that's actually going on with his life and reputation at the moment?
Yeah, the people who'd set that up came to us earlier as well to try and to see what stories about Johnny Depp and about Amber Heard they could give to us. And we were a little uncomfortable with it in that it didn't seem to be where we should be, what we should be doing. We didn't go forward with it. But it does happen a lot. You get things sent in as if they were real rather than sort of totally stage managed. And sometimes we miss them, but most of the times I think we've got six cents.
Just as a final question then, because we ask all our guests, what was the last piece of media you consumed, whether it was a film, an article you read, a book you read, that really engendered an emotional response that you'd recommend to our listeners?
Oh, actually, I'll tell you what it is. The thing that I've been recommending to everybody is a podcast called Gladiator. And it's done by someone from the Boston Globe. And it's about Aaron Hernandez, who was a NFL player who played for the Patriots, who got done for murder and then last year committed suicide in jail.
Oh, shit.
And I knew the story from the headlines and that, but the podcast is, you can't help but feel an emotional pull to it because it tries to give the story behind the story, I guess, how he had a very difficult upbringing, the kind of world in which football players suddenly are given $40 million a year and basically told they can do what they want, it doesn't really matter. And it turned out the fact that he was struggling with the fact that he was gay and didn't want the story to come out. There was a story in it from his best friend growing up that turned out they were having a love affair as well. And this guy's father was on the podcast and he was saying, I would never have accepted this. But now I realise that almost every reaction I've ever had, every prejudice I've ever had, anything I ever believed in was wrong. And I wish I could go back and do it all again and, be a father all over again. Just listening, I was sitting in a car, driving back up the motorway and I almost burst into tears because real stories, the stories of real lives that you don't always hear, have always affected me much more than, say, fiction.
So we still have a newsletter. I think we've probably only mentioned it about four times in this podcast already. Sign up, go to Twitter, find a link, go to the website, voices.media, find a link, sign up to our newsletter. Why haven't you done it already?
And it's a big week for us this week. As we may have mentioned once or twice, we've been writing a report called Media Moments 2018. And it looks at all the kind of key things that have happened over the year in sort of trust, platforms, reader revenue, that kind of thing. We look forwards and backwards, so it's going to be a really great read. It will be available to download from Wednesday at 12 p.m, so we'll send out a link out in our newsletter and social and everything else.
Is that 12 p.m. at lunchtime or 12 p.m. at night, or is that 12 a.m.?
That's 12 a.m.
Is this like a Harry Potter release? Will be there like people queuing around the block for it?
Night is 12 a.m. because then you get 1 a.m. So 12:01 a.m.
That's never good with times.
But regardless of what time it is, people are going to be queuing around the block, right? It's going to be like a Grand Theft Auto release.
Obviously.
Until next week, when we're going to be back with another absolutely fantastic guest. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.